Let's go ahead and start the recording and. I say to you, but let's get.
I'll just start it.
Go ahead, you're ready to record.
Okay. All right. All right, welcome everybody to our Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Interim Committee. My name is Representative Ryan Wilcox, with House Chair here with my counterpart Senator Grover. And he will actually be the one that drives most of this meeting today. We are at six members that are currently here, which means that we can't take any action yet. So we're going to start with item number five on the agenda that doesn't require us to take any action necessarily. So with that, we have some guests here from the AG's office. If you can go ahead and come on up. We're going to present on some things that have happened since the session, just to make us all aware of. And this is a phone call I did not expect to receive in the interim. So this is, I appreciate you being here today, Chris. And if you'd introduce yourself, tell us, share with us what your role is, and then and go ahead and begin the briefing. You have to speak. You have to speak in the microphone. Thank you. It might not be.
It's not powering up.
Maybe.
Okay.
Okay, we got.
Just while my laptop powers up. My name is Christopher Walden. I'm a supervisory special agent with the Utah Attorney General's office, and currently I'm the commander of the Economic Crimes Unit for the state of Utah. The task force is dual between the Utah Attorney General's office and the State Bureau of Investigations. So thanks for having me today. Let me just hook this up real quick. All right, we'll dive right into this. With the position that I'm in right now, we started receiving some cases and some reports of catalytic converter theft appearing or happening from all areas throughout the state of Utah. We had a couple of cases come in from Salt Lake Community College, where the Highway Patrol performs police functions, and we started to do some investigations. Primarily, how this came to us is that we tend to operate in the world of e-commerce, where buying and selling of stolen goods online, quite a market there for that. We started our investigation by pulling some data, and if you take a look at the trend chart here, in 2018 there were only 110 stolen cases or stolen catalytic converter cases throughout the state of Utah. In 2020 that jumped to 654 documented cases. That's a 595% increase in that three-year period. And if you look at the final number there for 2021, we were already on track. That was beginning January 1st and ending April 1st of 2021, so we were on track to beat the 2020 record. Catalytic converters are a necessary component for your vehicle. They are very expensive once they're removed. The damage to the victim's vehicle can range anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000 to replace. There are essentially two markets where these catalytic converters were being sold. We did have some that are sold to the legitimate scrap metal world, and we also had some being sold in parking lots of Walmart, Costco, any dark alleys, those type of things where they could buy and sell these catalytic converters. So we started to identify the problem. We realized that there was a large market in the e-commerce world, which is where we tend to operate. On April 26th, we began a multifaceted investigation with six law enforcement entities: the Utah Attorney General's Office, Department of Public Safety, State Bureau of Investigations, Sandy City Police Department, Unified Police Department, West Jordan City, and West Valley. And we began an operation where we wanted to do a targeted approach to gain a better understanding truly of what it was we were encountering and see if we could focus our efforts towards curbing this issue. The operation ran for 3 weeks. We recovered 124 catalytic converters, street values probably a little over $100,000. That's just the value of the catalytic converters and the precious metals on the inside. That's not the damage that's done to one of the victim's vehicles after it's been removed. We also recovered five bags of material, the honeycomb precious metal that's on the inside of those catalytic converters. And truly, that's where the market is. There are three precious metals on the inside of a catalytic converter that range in value, but they're very expensive. We did make three custodial arrests. Part of our operation, again, was to understand the legitimate scrap metal world. And the first week of our operation, we focused our efforts on compliance checks in compliance with 766-1403 on the legitimate scrap metal world to see if they were in compliance. We issued 13 criminal violations, 6 written warnings. There were 13 legitimate scrap metal dealers that were audited, and only 4 of those were compliant, so 30.78%. Week 2 and 3, we conducted undercover transactions where we operated on both sides of that market. We both bought catalytic converters from individuals where we posted online ads and had them respond, and we sold catalytic converters that we had purchased to individuals that were also buying in that market space. We did serve one storage unit search warrant, 1 vehicle search warrant, and 1 on a cellular phone. The impact to our communities with catalytic converters, they're very expensive. They're expensive to replace. They cannot, it's our understanding after speaking with some muffler shops, they cannot be re-welded back on or re-affixed to a vehicle once they're removed. That's all I have as far as a presentation. I'm willing to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate your time today. This was, like I said, I don't want to say a shock, but the experience taking a look at what had happened with the operation and the scope of where this has happened around the state. Can you give us a good idea really quickly of where these thefts have taken place and who's been involved behind the scenes?
Certainly. I think it would be fair to say that the thefts are occurring on a statewide basis. Even since some of the media stories have aired, I've had a number of phone call communications with investigators from all around the state. Every county, when we conducted our audits, we went from Davis County, Weber County, Salt Lake County, Tooele County, Utah County, to check with the legitimate scrap metal world where they were operating and to check for compliance there. But the problem itself, to the best of my knowledge, is absolutely statewide.
And so talk to us a little bit about who's behind this and what we've found there so far.
Sure, certainly. So the individuals that we arrested that were bringing us catalytic converters when we were working our undercover operation, most of them had a drug addiction and were using a catalytic converter essentially as a fiat currency. So they're trying to pay or to sell to get cash or to trade for narcotics. So there absolutely is just a criminal undertone to not just the theft of the catalytic converter, but the purpose or the intent of transferring possession of that later. We had a number of individuals, some groups working together, working in concert. We had documented cases from jurisdictions here in Salt Lake County where, you know, 2 people, 3 people would work together in concert because the value of those catalytic converters is so high and very, very, very low risk and very, very high reward. So a number of criminal groups and elements were working together. I believe very possibly still are.
Sounds like it. And you mentioned the cost there, $1,500, $2,000, depending on the vehicle for replacement. Is that something that is covered by insurance for most people?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I can get back to you on that. What I do know is that it's my understanding that unless you have full coverage insurance, they wouldn't cover apart from a vehicle being removed. What we did uncover was that the demographic that was essentially being targeted were individuals that, you know, probably a vulnerable portion of our society. They can't park their car in a garage or in a gated community. They have to park their car on the road or in their driveway. But we also had individuals who were parking at, you know, going to college, you know, at night or during the middle mm-hmm. of the day, where they would come out later and their catalytic converter had been removed. So there's a number of ways that they were being taken. Most of them were just with a relatively cheap saw, and they could be cut off in less than 2 minutes easily.
All right, so this, what I understand, this is a problem that targets the most vulnerable, those who can least afford to deal with the problem. We're talking about catalytic converters, so the sole purpose is to help clean the air out of our tailpipes, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. So I would hope that we would have the attention of some of our environmental friends concerned about that and air quality experts along the Wasatch Front. This is not just a simple smash and grab law enforcement issue. This is an environmental issue. This is a humanitarian issue when you talk about the populations that it affects, those who can't park it in a garage, who are on the street. So I really appreciate you coming in and giving us a quick briefing. Again, this is not the only time we'll talk about this. This is not the moment for solutions or public comment necessarily, but it is a time for us to be aware of the problem. I've seen, you know, we have, 300 and whatever that number was, documented cases so far this year. I've had Much like I'm sure the phone calls that you've received since some of the stories started airing, I'm hearing we're well over 500-600 so far right now. I think that we're just starting to understand the scope of it. And I appreciate the work of our law enforcement team here, especially throwing together the task force in such a quick way. That was sort of awesome to see, and appreciate the coordination there. Again, I don't know what that solution will look like as we move throughout the interim. We do appreciate, you know, our recyclers have approached us pretty quickly upon hearing that this was on the agenda, and we appreciate that. And they'll need to be part of whatever solution is that we come up with. And that's an important part of this too. So just to let everybody know that we will be looking at that. And this is not an insignificant harm for the families that it affects. And frankly, the rest of us who like to breathe. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Wilcox. We do have a couple questions and or comments. Representative Stoddard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, we.
It's because you're a Democrat.
Yeah.
I'm a little offended. Can we make note of that? So I work as a prosecutor. This is an issue that I hear come up. I hear about it from my constituents as well.
Certainly.
So you're in a room full of policymakers. Are there any policies you feel are lacking that are allowing us to investigate or handle these types of cases?
You know, that's a great question. I'd love to engage into some dialogue about, you know, some meaningful long-term solutions. I really think that the operation was, I'm hoping, a short-term solution with some media coverage and really highlighting the issue, making people aware. One of the issues we ran into when we looked at the data was that a lot of folks had parked their car last Wednesday. They didn't know, you know, with COVID, they were not going to work every day. So I think with raising some awareness, I hope that answers some of the short-term side. As far as a policy, I think there's a number of areas that we could explore. There's some existing models, I think, that we could look at and see if we could model catalytic converters and theft and what the point of sale transaction needs to look like.
Okay. Well, you've got our ear, so thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Reby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is industry looking at any way to maybe like chip a catalytic converter so that it went stolen, you could track it? Or is there anything that industry is looking at that we could possibly support?
You know, that's a great question. I have had some conversations with some folks on the inside of the industry on the legitimate scrap metal world, the recycler world. There are some identifying numbers on a catalytic converter. It's called an imprint number. Not all of them have an imprint number, but that number, it doesn't necessarily tie that catalytic converter to that VIN. It will typically give you a span. It'll, you know, like 1997 to 2003 Honda Civic, something like this. But that data is still valuable because we have the ability to take that imprint number and do some reverse searching and say, you know, in the greater law enforcement community, has anybody lost a catalytic converter that belongs to a 97 through 2003 Honda Civic? So as far as your question where, is there anybody in the industry that's willing to chisel in an owner identified number or an owner applied number? I haven't heard that. But right now that imprint number is not being captured. And that alone, I think, could help solve some of the crimes when they're removed.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any other comments. Again, just a reminder, committee, we're not taking comments, we're not taking any action, just letting the committee know we're going to tee this up and then keep your eyes open and ears open, and we'll try to figure out a solution. I'm sure it'll be fun. So that concludes. Thank you very much for being here.
So I can go this time?
I think so. Looks like, yes, you're allowed to go. So you're free.
Thank you.
So to committee, just we are going out of order a little bit. We're going to accommodate people that do have other meetings to get to. So we're going to go to item number 4, law enforcement recruitment and retention. And he is here. So if you'd like to come on up, Representative Gwynn, or from your mic, either place. Let's get you queued up here.
Actually, I'm gonna sit over there so I can see the screen.
Okay.
There's two parts to this presentation today. One is Representative Gwynn, and then one is me, and I'm one of those that I have to leave in about 2 minutes for a time certain legislative assignment. So
what's that?
So just very quickly, I'll just share with you my portion of this before I have to leave. And that is, we had a couple of sort of baby steps through the interim dealing with the mental health space and as it relates to first responders. We had a bill from Representative Kwan, where we got an appropriation to partner with Utah State University that to start a new program where we're cross-training law enforcement with mental health specialties. and, you know, and vice versa. And I think that's a good model to, as a baby step, that we need to expand across the state. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And then, you know, a number of other issues that sort of scratched around the edges, but that's one of those where we need to do a better job of expanding not just access, but the culture of expectation from the state that mental health is not an appendage. There's not something inherently wrong with taking care of that. In fact, it's an expectation of working in law enforcement for the state of Utah, that we all check in and that we all get treatment when we need it. And I think from a cultural standpoint, we need to study and decide what that looks like in written policy in order to change that part of the culture. So there's a number of things we'll be looking at with that, but that's sort of part of this. And I'm looking forward to, I've been discussing with Representative Gwynn quite a bit what that looks like for recruitment and retention. But just to give you an idea before I take off here, last year, y'all know in my neighborhood, we lost Officer Nate Lyday, who was shot and killed. And, you know, he's a young, frankly, a very young man and a beautiful little family. And he's well known throughout the Ogden Police Department. We lost a number of officers in Weber County, at least three that I'm aware of, not because of the struggles that they were having with the loss of Officer Lyday, but because of the struggles that their families were having. Because their spouses couldn't send them to work anymore in that job. So we have to change the concept a little bit. This isn't just about our officers and what they go through, because they put on the badge and they do that. But we have to look at how this affects our families as well, how it affects their families. And if that means extending benefits to spouses and children, then that's what we need to do. But there'll be a number of things that we look at throughout the interim, but I am not comfortable leaving the situation as it is. Right now we have a handful of departments that have been really aggressive, and that's been a good thing in this space, but we have far too many that don't have the ability to do that, either don't have the resources or that really just don't understand why they need to do it. And so we need to change that narrative a little bit. That'll be fun, it'll be hard, but it'll be worth it. So hopefully that can help us a little bit with this retention issue. Representative Gwynn.
Just to follow up on that, someone can double check my math, but Officer Lyday's name was the 147th officer that was placed on the memorial wall last week. He's the 10th from Ogden City Police Department alone. So this is a real issue that our communities are combating. So I'm gonna leave it up to John just to place some information up on the screen. And as he does, I'll just kind of elaborate to it really quick. And I'll tell you where it is that we started. I'll tell you where we're going. And then I'll fill everybody in on where we're at currently as far as recruitment and retention in public safety. And when I talk about public safety, I'm actually talking about not only law enforcement, the first line responder, but I'm also talking about firefighters, corrections, sheriff's deputies, and other state law enforcement agencies that fall under DPS.
Okay, just really quick. Senator Reby, I have your light on. Did you have a question, or is that from the previous? Okay, sorry. Go ahead, continue, Representative.
So I'll just wait for some of this information to come up on the screen. So what we're looking at currently is what really started this discussion is back in 2010, the state legislature, under the circumstances that the state was confronting in 2010, implemented the Tier 2 retirement program. Now, public safety personnel at the line level, the municipal level, they predicted that as a result of Tier 2, that eventually there would be some sort of recruitment and retention problem. We are now seeing that. The problem is what they couldn't predict at the time, and while the fix may have been appropriate at the time, is that the operating environment for public safety has changed. And so we're seeing a recruitment and retention crisis, as put by Sheriff Jensen, who is the chairman of the Utah Sheriff's Association. We have a crisis that's been created as a result of this Tier 2 and the operating environment. And so I opened a bill file back in 2021 general session, HB 150, and what I was asking for was just to allow those officers who wanted to remain as officers, who retired, allow them to come back and let them come back to work after a 60-day cooling off period as opposed to 1 year.
Well, the purpose of the one-year period was to, if officers were going to retire, to keep them out so as not to affect the pension fund. Tier two actually changed the funding mechanism for the pension fund. So when we talk about tier two and this enhancement that I'm going to be proposing, I'm not looking to change the funding mechanism that was implemented in tier two. I'm only looking to rescind 5 years of service that was incorporated as a part of tier two. So one of the biggest hangups I had in the 60-day cooling off period is just to allow an officer to come back after 60 days was going to cost the state approximately $12 million in ongoing funds. And the reality of it is that really wasn't going to fix the problem, right? If we have a recruitment and a retention problem, allowing retirees to come back to work isn't going to fix the problem. So I went back to URS and I asked them to look at providing some kind of fiscal analysis of what it would do if we took tier two and we kept the funding mechanism the same. We allowed officers to come back to 60 days if they were so inclined. But we said, okay, we're going to go back to 20 years of service instead of 25. And so this is the actuarial that was given to me by Utah Retirement Systems. And I'm not quite the expert at reading these. But it's my understanding that the cost to the employee is going to go up, not necessarily municipalities, but the municipalities themselves, if they were so inclined, could cover some of those costs the employee is going to pay in their pension. And so if you look at section one, if we implement tier two as an enhanced, in other words, we just reduce the 5 years of service, keeping the funding mechanism the same. You can see those costs on the left as they go up between now and 2035. So in 2021, between 2021 and 2022, that cost would actually go up. I believe that's the state, the far right column, $23 million. Am I reading that right, John? Okay.
That's my understanding.
All right.
I didn't prepare this, but.
Okay. And so this is just to provide tier two public safety with tier one benefits, right? And so all we're saying is we're going to let them retire at 20 years instead of 25 years. Okay. Some people in this room have heard me talk about how our military retirees, they can retire after 20 years. We're asking our officers and our firefighters to do 25. Just last year, we had a floor debate in the House, and we actually approved and sanctioned military retirees coming back to Utah, staying in Utah, double dipping, and then giving them a tax benefit on their retiree income. We're not willing to do that for our local public safety. So we're sending a mixed message, right? Why are we treating our public safety different than we are our military retirees? So I've reached out to Utah Leagues and Cities and Towns. I reached out to the Utah Sheriff's Association, Utah Chiefs Association, DPS, Department of Corrections, the AG's office. And we've created a survey. And this survey went live last week. And these questions on the survey are visible here on the board. And what we're looking at is we're looking at recruitment and retention opinions of those at the line level live, right? We're seeing this right now. I met with Wayne Bradshaw, and I actually got some of the results of some of this survey. This is just a snapshot, but in the last week, we have received 650 responses. Okay. Let's see. I'm just going to go through these really quick because, you know, we think we see the problem, or we think we know the problem, and then the data tells us a different story. And I think the data is suggesting that Sheriff Jensen is right when we talk about a crisis. So in this survey, we have just a little over 400 respondents that are tier one, and we have just under 300 that are tier two. We have others that may be in other retirement funds, such as UTA. Okay. When we look at years of service, again, out of 650 respondents, we have 300 or so that are nearing, at, or past retirement eligibility. We only have 300 that are willing to fall in place. We actually have more people leaving than we have people coming in, and that is current. We ask the question, if you are considering leaving law enforcement or public safety, what is your intent? Out of 650 people, only 200 were willing to stay in public safety. 220 of those were going to leave to go to a completely different industry. 50 of those were looking to go into public safety in another state. And another 110 of those were looking to retire and get out altogether. Again, we have more people wanting to leave than we have people wanting to come in. 650 respondents, how is your morale? High, moderate, or low? Only about 210 said that their morale was high. Over 500 indicated that their morale was either moderate or low. This survey is going to be going on for another 3 weeks. We have over 5,000 people that we have access to. Again, I just wanted to give you a glimpse as to what we're looking at right now. Let's see. I would recommend a career in law enforcement or firefighting to family and friends. Strongly agree, 25 out of 650 people. Strongly disagree, over 350 people would vehemently oppose recommending a career in public safety to a family or a friend. So, one of the battles I had when I was working on my bill last year was we had municipalities and counties blaming the state for its implementation of Tier 2. And we have legislators blaming municipalities because they aren't paying their officers enough. I had a theory that it was probably both, and the data is actually starting to bear that out. The top two concerns for public safety people, number one, increased pay, number two, retirement benefits. And it isn't so much the benefit that they want more money, they're okay with the defined contribution that was incorporated in Tier 2. What they're saying is 5 years is too much. And we actually have experts in PTSD and first responders that will also agree that 25 years is too much, and quote, 20 years is more than enough. And I have that for anybody who wants that. I've got that gentleman, I've got access to him too. So again, this is just a glimpse. More people are going out than are coming in. More people want to leave than want to stay. We do have a crisis on our hands. It's gonna be a heavy lift. It's probably not gonna be cheap. But I think the state and the cities are equally accountable in wanting to maintain public safety. It's their constitutional duty. Now, John, if you could go back to what that graph you just had up, would you mind? So just to give you an idea, right, we talk about correlation versus causation. We talk about anecdotes. So 2010, Tier 2 is passed, 2011, okay? We have enrollees and graduates in post, and what we know now is that over the last 10 years, post-enrollment and graduation rates in law enforcement alone, this is not firefighting, but post-enrollment and graduation rates alone have declined by 50% in the last 10 years. Okay, I was in a meeting as a new legislator, rookie legislator. I probably sound like one, a little nervous right now, right? But Governor Cox even acknowledged that his own community is falling victim to some of the policies of Tier 2. Okay, they're having trouble getting law enforcement because the ones that want to leave and maybe go work for a smaller agency that's not so busy, they can't do it. Was there any more graphs on this one, John? Particularly the one talking about the cost, the direct inverse, the cost for cities. I think it's one more down. One more. Okay, right here. So back in 2010 or prior to 2010, you had a pool of candidates that were wanting to be in law enforcement that were so large that they were willing to pay to sponsor themselves or put themselves through the academy. They were willing to pay out of pocket knowing that there was a possibility or a great likelihood that they were never ever going to land a job in law enforcement. They were still willing to pay that money. You can also see that over time, as the amount of officers that are willing to self-sponsor goes down, the requirement for cities, counties, or state agencies to sponsor those applicants has gone up. So it's actually costing municipalities and counties and the state more to keep the status quo. And the reason I bring that up is because, again, it might be expensive to fix this on the front end. I think we can take care of it on the back end. But the argument I'm making is, what are the unknown costs if we continue to allow this to go on the path that it's currently moving on? So with that, if you have any questions, I'll entertain what I can.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative, for your presentation. Representative Stoddard.
Thank you, and I want to thank Representative Gwynn for this work, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to share this data.
Yeah, actually, so I literally printed this off yesterday night, or last night, so I wasn't able to get this a digital copy sent out, but yes, I will absolutely get it sent out. I can have John, if he doesn't mind, the information that he has, I've been sending him over the last couple of weeks, and he can mail that out to the group as well.
Just as a quick note, so everything that I've been showing up here, I've actually been pulling directly from the meeting materials on the website. So it is indeed available for, but.
Yes, makes me look smarter than I am. So, and I want to thank Representative Gwynn for working on this. This is a huge issue. I look at the agencies that I work with, and you know, they hire for 5 spots and you'll get 6 applicants, and there's really no competition. And that's where you look at a lot of our law enforcement issues, and it's because we don't have the competition, the people who want to be there, because we're not offering the benefits and the pay that they deserve. So thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Romero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you, Representative Gwynn. I know Representative Wilcox had mentioned this. I know what you go through as well, not exactly. I'm a public employee as well, and I'm tier one, and there's a big difference between tier one and tier two. But the question I had with Representative Wilcox and you working together, was he talking about, and maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't, about mental health services for families of first responders as well, not just first responders?
So this is kind of we're attacking this from 2 different angles, right? So he's focused on the mental health component. I'm focused merely on the recruitment and retention component. You know, arbitrarily, I think we can make the argument that if you are at significant risk for PTSD after 20 years, you're not going to be any better off by having to work an additional 5.
I would agree.
So we're combating it. We're combating this from 2 different angles, hoping to create a solution that will assist with the mental health, but also with recruitment and retention.
And just one more comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to note, you know, you and I were neighbors in our offices, but you know, as you know, someone who works for a municipality and someone who represents the city as well, and talking about police reform, I still believe in those efforts, but I also feel like we have to pay our law enforcement officers what they deserve, and also the 20 years is definitely something I fully support, just working in public service and seeing what people, first responders, have to go through.
Can I respond to that, Chair?
Sure, of course.
Okay, so everyone in law enforcement agrees, right? I mean, police reform to people who don't understand police reform means lots of different things. But to those who understand what police reform is, you know, even though we might be sitting on 2 different sides of the aisle, we might be sitting in 2 different sides of the road, right, from a public safety standpoint or from a citizen standpoint. Arguably, this last session was a good year for police reform, right? We codified a lot of best practices. I'm proud to say that a lot of the stuff that we did codified, I work for an agency and I work in a county where a lot of that stuff is already noted in policy as best practices. So the law enforcement community agrees there needs to be some reform. And this is just a component of that reform. It isn't just policy changes on how we respond to calls. It is all encompassing. And we cannot be so narrowly, you know, focused on, you know, our response to calls, our pay, mental health, right? It's all encompassing.
Okay, thank you. Senator Reby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also a civil servant. I come from a long line of civil servants. My family are all police officers back in New York. And I remember in 10th grade, there was a call over the radio that a lieutenant had been shot, and my dad was a lieutenant, and I had no idea if my dad was gonna come home that night. So I appreciate every angle we're coming at this from. I'd also like to describe that I My understanding is it takes $100,000 to train a police officer. And so we're not even looking at the cost of just having a revolving door of having these officers. The first 5 years as a teacher or an officer or anybody in a job, you're not really hitting your stride yet. So I think that we're really doing a disservice to our communities by having this revolving door. I'd also like to talk about the double dipping. I would like this to be called reclaiming talent. We're not double dipping. That has a negative connotation. We're reclaiming talent. I work closely with some friends up in Alta, and they've left the URS system, and now that they're in a smaller community that's not as physically demanding, they are struggling with having their talent reclaimed. So I think there's a lot of aspects we can look at to try to make it more conducive for our younger officers to stay in our more exciting areas, and for our older, more veteran people to maybe, you know, reclaim their talent someplace else. So I applaud you for highlighting some of these issues, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Senator. Can I respond to that as well, Chair?
Of course.
So I actually, that's a breath of fresh air hearing you say that. I've been, you know, last session I got a ton of resistance, and over the course of the last few months that has actually changed. And I do think we need to reframe the conversation. Double dipping is a very negative term for what reclaiming talent. I absolutely love that. I'll give you credit for that too. Box Elder County Sheriff's Office. It costs them anywhere between $124,000 to $142,000 to train an officer from scratch. They may or may not get off FTO. They may or may not get off probation. If they get off probation, that officer is going to be there for another year, and they're going to go to another agency that's going to be willing to pay them $10,000 or $15,000 more a year. And you're right. This is a young man's game or a young woman's game. I recognize my mortality, and I'm not capable of doing the same things that I was 20 years ago when I first got into this career. And I think it needs to be said, I have nothing to gain from this personally. I've already hit that magic number. So there's nothing that any of these policies or changes that I'm hoping for are going to benefit me personally. But to the double dipping aspect, back in 2010, what they were trying to fix was you would have administrators drawing salaries of $120,000, $150,000 a year. They would retire in place, continue to draw their salary, and draw their pension. That is abhorrent. That should be fixed. But when we talk about reclaiming talent, we're talking about people who want to go to a smaller agency and can work for $19 an hour and just be made whole. And so I'm not talking about people who are abusing the system. I think we've got them out of it. And I think we can do this in a way that prevents people from abusing it in the future, for sure.
Okay, thank you. Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. This actually passed the year before I came into the legislature, so there really wasn't much I could do at the time. But there's been a lot of effort. Unfortunately, it's never really gotten a lot of traction. The one criticism that I have always had has been this. When we have a top-level chief that has reached their retirement age but wants to continue serving, their options are to either retire, receive the retirement that they earned, that they were promised, that they deserve, and then leave the state, where they will then get a salary from another state. Meanwhile, we have to hire someone, which is probably an officer or a chief from another state, to come in and take that position that we just vacated from someone who grew up in Ogden or West Valley. So I have always failed to see the savings from paying a salary to someone who came from another state while paying retirement to someone who left our state. That has always been a disconnect to me. And so I'm very excited to hear you say that there's finally movement, because I feel like we've been pushing against this for at least 11 years. So anything that I can do to help, anything I can do to support, I'm there.
And I appreciate that, Senator. We get caught up in the what's it going to cost us right now, what's it going to cost us tomorrow. We ignore what the potential costs are going to be in the long run due to liability or those hidden costs as a result of variables that we can't, you know, predict are going to occur. But that goes back to the discussion we were having on the House floor last year, you know, or a couple months ago. What's the message we're sending our officers? If you're in the military, we want you to double dip. We want you to double dip in Utah, and we're going to give you your income tax-free. However, if you're a police officer or firefighter, you're going to work 5 extra years. That's not fair to them, and it's not fair to the communities they serve.
Okay, thank you. That concludes any questions or comments. Thank you for the presentation, and we'll be working on this.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Thatcher.
Do we have a quorum, Mr. Chair?
We do.
Seeing that we have a quorum and seeing as how this motion can only be made in the first interim meeting each year, I would make a motion that we authorize the chairs of this committee to open bill files on behalf of this committee.
The motion before us is to authorize the chairs to open bill files. Any discussion to that motion? Representative Miles.
I agree with that motion. I assume it goes without saying that if possible, the chairs could keep us informed as to what you're looking at and the need for those kind of bills, but I would support that motion.
Any other further discussion?
Only that Representative Miles has a fantastic tie. It is absolutely beautiful, sir.
Thank you. Jerry Garcia.
Of course it's a Jerry Garcia. What's the title of the painting? I'm wearing Clockworks today.
I don't know. I can't read it.
All right, that'll be Senator Thatcher's sum. And so the motion before us is to authorize the chairs to open bill files relating to this committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That passes unanimously. Okay, thank you. We're going to now go to committee business. I'm looking for a motion. I'll go back to Representative Miles for approval of the minutes of November 17th, 2020.
So moved.
That motion before us. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of November 17th, 2020, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? There are none. We'll now go to John, who's going to take us through committee business and required reports we need to hear.
Thank you, Chair Rover. Let me just go ahead and pull up and share some of my screen here. Let's do this on Zoom. So as Senator Grover has indicated, we have some administrative business to take care of up front, so I'll try to be quick because I know there's plenty of other things that we have to consider. The first thing that we need to briefly discuss is that there is if we look at the meeting materials that are available online, you should see a list of what has been made available to the committee. And that list includes a comprehensive full list of statutorily required reports. Those are the reports that are required by law to be given to this committee, whether it be reported through a physical copy of the report or a digital copy of the report, or if it needs to be presented to the committee in person. So it makes those distinctions. We also have included in, and on the issue of statutorily required reports, we do have one report that was required for today from the Attorney General's office. And that is a report that gives a summary of constitutional challenges that have been made and the Attorney General's response to those challenges. Those are, if certain challenges have been made to statute. So that report is available under meeting materials for you to look at. We also have included in meeting materials an overview of the Open and Public Meetings Act. So I can actually go ahead and open that up real quick. We're not going to go over this now because if you attended your morning meetings, you should have received a good, thorough overview of updates to the Open and Public Meetings Act. But we did include the document in our meeting materials for today's meeting in case you needed a refresher on that as well, or in the event that you were able to attend your morning meeting. So just be aware that that is also available. We also have available for your review the sunset and repealers that have been assigned to this legislative committee. So you can scroll down and see law is under the law category here. These are the three statutes that have been assigned to our committee to be reviewed to assess whether or not these sections should be sunsetted or repealed. So those are the sections that are under review by this committee, and the way that typically works is that individuals who are associated with those sections can be brought before the committee to explain their thoughts as to whether or not they think those sections should be retained or if they should be left to repeal or sunset as is currently constituted in statute. Another document that we have available for us is, let me bring this one up. We'll talk a little bit more about it later. But we also have a document that provides an overview of laws that passed during the general session that in some way can be categorized as bills that made changes to law enforcement training or law enforcement policies. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I just wanted to make you aware that this document is also available for your review on the website. So with that, those are the main documents that are available under committee materials. And we just ask that if you have any questions as you review those documents, to please don't hesitate to reach out to staff. We're more than happy to provide clarifications on those items. So with that, before I'll also talk a little bit about item number two, but before I move on to that, I figured I'd give a little bit of time in case anybody has any questions about what's been stated already.
John, I don't see any questions. Please proceed.
All right. So for our second item, we do have, and this one, I will bring this up as a separate document here. This will be available under meeting materials. And this is the Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Interim Committee's list of approved study items. So these are the items that were approved by the Legislative Management Committee and assigned to this committee, this interim committee. And there are two main things that need to be done with regards to this document. The first is that it is within the power of the committee to review the items, and apologize, it looks like that screen's pretty fuzzy, but I can read them out loud for those in the room, but to review the items and see if there's any changes that the committee would like to make, because under rule, the committee is at liberty to, by motion, make changes to this document. And once the document is in a place where the committee feels comfortable with it, then the committee is to vote and approve and accept the Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Interim Committee study items. So right now, the items that are listed are mental health and public safety. And as a description, it is a charge to study the various ways in which mental health, law enforcement, and public safety intersect. Privacy and criminal justice is the next approved study item. That item is described as the charge to study issues related to balancing the protections of the Fourth Amendment with effective policing strategies. The next item is driving under the influence. So this would relate to studying matters that deal with sentencing for DUI violations. The next item is recruitment and retention, which there's already been some discussion of today. So that would be to study current status of recruitment and retention efforts among law enforcement agencies. The next item is law enforcement training and policies. And this item encompasses the charge to review substantive changes that were made during the 2021 general session concerning law enforcement training and conduct standards, and also to open up to the possibility of studying whether further changes are necessary. And the final item that's been approved by LMC is bail reform, and that is simply acknowledging that judiciary will be studying this item during the interim, but that the Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Interim Committee expects to receive updates regarding the ongoing efforts to reform the bail system. So essentially to be included as part of some of the discussions that will be going on and conducted by the Judiciary Interim Committee. So those are the items as currently constituted. But as I mentioned, at some point during this meeting, the committee may make a motion to add or remove something from this item, or make a motion to simply adopt and accept the committee, the study items as currently constituted. So I'll open it up briefly if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Looks like you're good. Thanks, John.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Oh,
sorry. Representative Romero.
Yeah. Oh, there it works. Quick question. I don't know necessarily if I wanted this as a study item, but it's up to the chair's discretion if we want to put something on the agenda during the interim, even if it's not on there, or does it have to be on there in order to have that conversation? Because as you know, sexual assault and sexual assault prevention is very important to me and usually comes through this committee. I'm not saying we have to do it as an interim study item, but it was something I would like to address when we're in the interim.
No, that's a great question. And the best way that I suppose I can answer that as staff is that ultimately, according to rule, the chairs have final discretion on what is and is not included on an agenda.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, go ahead, John. Yeah, feel free to proceed.
So the next item, which we've actually already discussed a little bit, is law enforcement training and policies. And as staff, I have been asked to at least jumpstart this conversation, which does involve also discussion, as you'll see in the description on the agenda, of bills that are slated for the special session. But to initiate the conversation, I was asked by the chairs to provide a very brief overview of some of these, of the bills that passed during the 2021 general session that related to this topic of police reform. So let me go ahead and pull that up. So I provided in this document that's available, again, under meeting materials, a very quick overview. There are some numbers in there just mostly to drive home the point that Utah followed, or at least was in line with a trend nationwide that focused on what sometimes is colloquially termed police reform bills. But I think as it was articulated earlier by Representative Gwynn, police reform is a very broad term, can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And so the focus of this document is specifically to highlight bills that were striving to make changes either to training for peace officers or law enforcement, or to, you know, internal policies of peace officers and law enforcement. And so as noted in the introduction here, the introductory paragraph, NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislators, noted that more than 2,000 bills over the past year fell into that category across all the states in the country. And so that's certainly enough to constitute a strong trend.
Okay, it looks like we have either a question or comment from Senator Reedy.
Yeah.
Thank you. So the agenda has things numbered 1, 2, 3, and then the meeting materials are 1A, 1-2, 1B, and they're not lining, so we're having trouble following you. So
yes,
if you could reference the letter and the number on the meeting agenda items that coincide with the agenda, that would help us.
No, that's a great point.
Thank you.
And I guess to clarify on that, it's because we ended up doing a couple of the agenda items out of order. But so this, the what we're discussing right now would be item number 3. Mm-hmm. And so under the meeting materials, you should see something, and it was actually included also under item number 1. It will say 1C, Police Reform 2021 Overview.
Thank you. We're opening each one of them and we're not finding them. So thank you for referencing the number and the letter so we can find them.
not a problem. Yeah, sorry. I apologize that the screen is a little fuzzy, so that's probably not super helpful. But yeah, so it's, if you're having trouble seeing it on the screen, would like to pull it up on your own, it's item 1C, Police Reform 2021 Overview. And that's the document, Law Enforcement Training and Policies. So as I mentioned, the National Conference of State Legislatures noted that this clearly constituted a trend over the past years for these types of numbers. At least 25 bills, and I say that with a lot of qualifications, were drafted and numbered and made public during the 2021 general session in Utah that fell under this broader category. And again, it's more art than science to try to categorize some of the bills. And so But we certainly did our best to categorize. And ultimately, 18 such bills were passed by the legislature. So you can see that, you know, there were a number of bills that were publicly proposed and numbered, and the majority of those did end up passing through the legislature. And of the 18 bills that were passed, I did my best to, for clarity's sake and just for the sake of being helpful, we categorized those into three subcategories. And so those fell under what we called standards and training. So those might be bills that are more focused on changes to peace officer standards and training policies, and other such things. Or it also might be internal law enforcement agency policies on that govern expectations for law enforcement's behavior and policies on how they interact with the public. Another topic, again, a pretty broad one, is changes to data and transparency. So these were just bills that the focus seemed to be on trying to make it so that the public had a greater understanding, or the legislature had a greater understanding of how law enforcement operates internally, and also what some of the trends might be in terms of crime and criminal justice in the state. And then the third category, which didn't have quite as many as the others, but there we also noticed that there were a number of bills that passed that dealt with mental health and how that related to law enforcement and first responders. And so those are you can see that there's three that are listed under that category. So for the sake of time, we opted not to go individually through each bill with the committee, but we did try to provide a brief but substantive summary of each bill. So we encourage members of the committee to look over this this summary document. And if you have any questions about the bills or any questions about some of the information that's cited here, please don't hesitate to reach out to reach out to staff, and let us know, and we'll be happy to be as responsive as we can. So with that, I'll open it up if there's any questions that anyone on the committee might have for staff, and if not, we can proceed to the special session legislation.
Seeing none, let's proceed to special session legislation.
It's non-debatable.
We're here to do the people's work, Senator. Okay, so as you're following your agendas, we've completed 1, 2, and we're on 3, and now we're going to go to Representative Romero, HB 1001.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we passed my initial bill during this general session that I think everyone supported, I don't think we had any no votes, we didn't put an implementation date. So all this bill does is it implies that we will start the requirements as of July 2021, because if we would have went with the original bill, it would only give law enforcement 2 months to meet those requirements. And that concludes my presentation.
Okay, any questions for committee or any other comments? Okay, seeing none.
Just for the committee's information and folks at home, the language of the bill is available under 3A, 2021 for special session HB 1001. So I know that there were concerns about being able to kind of follow that, but that's where it's
available. Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't give you the... we don't have to vote on this, correct? I'm just telling you what's coming up during the special session. That is correct.
Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. It's my understanding that the purpose of having it on the agenda here is so that we can actually have a hearing and take action on the bill. And so I personally would prefer, assuming we still have quorum, that we go ahead and take action on this bill.
You want to comment to that, Senator Representative?
I'm fine with that. This is a bill that we all supported. And what this is training for our peace officers. It's 16 hours of required training when it comes to de-escalation and helping people with mental health crisis. This also incorporates Representative Elison's bill, because his bill had the same thing. It didn't have a start date, and so we didn't want to only get provider peace officers 2 months to complete this training. So we're changing the enactment date to July of 2021, so that gives them a year.
Okay, go to Senator Thatcher for a motion.
Thank you. I would move that we favorably recommend the bill.
Would you like to speak to that?
I would not.
Oh, yeah, sorry, did not speak to that. Oh, yeah, go ahead and speak to that. I'd like to speak to that motion.
I would not like to speak
okay,
to that motion.
Thank you. We'd like to go to the public. Does anyone here from the public like to comment on this? Just to make sure we go through our steps correctly. Seeing none. Okay, back to Representative Romero, if you have any comments at all.
I wave.
Okay, wave. All right, the motion before us is to approve the changes we've heard about in HB 1001. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that will be passed unanimously and on to our session
Thank
tomorrow.
You.
Senator Main. I don't see Senator Main here for SB 1004. And Ray was here.
He's outside. He's trying to grab him.
So if committee will just indulge us for just a minute, we'll see if we can track down Representative Ray.
Can you turn off?
No, I don't want to. I want to hear everything you say.
I don't know if you want to.
Okay, you're off. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Ray.
You. I'm just going to grab the bill real quick.
And so what we are going to do is, you may not have heard, we're just going to take your presentation, which we, and then we'll take a vote and see how we feel about it.
Thank you, and I apologize. I had four bills in committees today, so and they've all been in the different buildings, but they haven't been in a row, so they've been like crisscrossing. So what we have with this is one we passed during the session, and what it allows is for non-citizens who are here legally to become police officers. And we made the change and then post-called and said, we missed something on this. We're ready to implement, but we can't, because part of the law still says that in order to apply to be a police officer, you have to be a citizen. So we fixed the post-certification part. We didn't catch the application part. So that's what this bill fixes. It brings the application portion in alignment with the post, what they need to be certified. That's the bill.
Okay. I think we most all of us remember that bill. Any comments for or questions for Representative Ray? Go to the public. See none. Oh, we come back to.
If we have no public comment.
There is no public comment, so we'll come back to the committee for further questions or action. So you're in order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I make a motion that we favorably pass Senate Bill 1004.
Okay, so motion for us is to pass SB 1004. Back to the sponsor of the bill.
Always summation. Thank you.
So the motion for us is to pass out SB 1004. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That is unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Ray. Okay, so as mentioned before, in case you came late, we did do 4 and 5 already on the agenda. And so we're on to number 6 on our agenda, master offense list. And we welcome Monica Diaz from the Sentencing Commission. Welcome, Monica.
Yes. Perfect. Works for me.
Is that the one that you like?
Yes. Okay. Monica Diaz, I am the director for the Utah Sentencing Commission. We are charged with presenting to you a list of all offenses in Utah after an updated list after every legislative session. Next slide. In this session, we had some added offenses. There was one first degree felony added, 2 second degree felonies, 9 third degree felonies, 7 class A misdemeanors, 11 class B misdemeanors, 0 class C's, and 3 infractions.
Monica, excuse me, could you do us a favor, me pull the either microphone a little bit closer? Let's see if that works.
Is that better?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
It's the first time I've been accused of being soft. though in the material handouts is a master offense list report, and so each of those offenses is designated by statute and their title. The next slide, John. There were 2 offenses that were repealed. Both had to do with electronic communication harassment of a minor. They were recodified into different offenses, but those specific offenses were repealed. The next one. We had 2 offenses that were enhanced from their previous designation. Aggravated human smuggling became a first degree felony, and human smuggling became a second degree felony. We can go to the next slide. We reduced some offenses that electronic communication harassment for second or subsequent offenses reduced from a third degree felony to a class A misdemeanor. And so today on our books, this gives us a total of 109 first degree felonies, 209 second degree felonies, 411 third degree felonies, 396 class A misdemeanors, the bulk of our offenses being class B misdemeanors with 814, 112 class C misdemeanors, and 287 infractions. And that is it for the current master offense list, which is also included in the materials.
Okay, does that conclude your presentation?
That does.
Okay, any questions, comments from committee? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'll go into item 7, Justice Reinvestment Initiative Progress Report. Welcome, Mr. Tom Ross from CCJJ.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. As mentioned, my name is Tom Ross, and I'm the Executive Director of CCJJ. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about JRI and maybe more specifically about how that ties into Representative Miles HB 44 and what CCJJ is doing to try to move forward with the requirements of HB 44. There were 4 areas that HB 44 specifically looked at, and that's ensuring oversight and accountability, supporting local correction systems, improving and expanding reentry and treatment services, and strengthening probation and parole supervision. I can say I've been in this position now for 5 months, and of course I spent several years on the law enforcement side. And when it comes to talking about JRI and what is working or not working and what we should or should not do, there are a lot of different ideas, and it's difficult as a policy organization to help determine maybe best policies. It's been difficult to really know exactly what's happening region by region across the state. It was clear in my mind, and as I spoke with staff members of CCJJ who have been involved in this in a different arena, I was involved in this as the president of the Chiefs of Police Association for nearly 5 years, that if we're going to work this out, we almost need to go back and start region by region, understanding what is working and what is not working. And so when you talk about ensuring oversight and accountability, when you have a philosophy, a justice reinvestment initiative is a significant shift in how we see criminal justice in our state. I can tell you, I came in as my first year as president of the association in 2015, right after when JRI started. I had very little conversations before. I've had hundreds of meetings and conversations since. I believe that the concept of what JRI is trying to accomplish is right. Treatment versus incarceration, especially for substance use and mental health, where we can make it work, is the right goal. And I don't think anyone would argue, you don't have to look any further than your own families and your extended families to see where this need exists. We cannot just lock up and warehouse everyone that has a substance use addiction or a mental health problem. And we found over decades that when we try to do that, the numbers in our prison system are extremely high in significant percentages. I've heard as high as 70%, 75% have mental health and substance use problems. So the idea that we would try to find a better way to help people that have an illness, which is what we're talking about, I think makes sense to everyone. What becomes less clear is, what is JRI and how do we make that work? When I look at what JRI was in 2015, it's different today in 2021. Not in a bad way. It's not necessarily that we're not doing the right things, but it is evolving. You cannot implement a program of this magnitude and not have unintended consequences, not have ways that we can improve or enhance, and not have new ideas come up while we're having these conversations. So I would strongly say to everyone that is talking both positive and negative about JRI that maybe we need to stop pushing that narrative and start focusing on what is working region by region and what is not working. In order to do that, it's going to take multiple conversations and meetings with stakeholders in each portion of our state. And we've already started working on that. From the time the session ended, I've had an opportunity to meet with several of our associations and stakeholder groups, including the League of Cities and Towns, the Association of Counties, the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs Association, several of state agencies, DPS, Corrections, Board of Pardons and Parole, and the list goes on. And what we are doing is setting the foundation to start having these regional meetings where we can maybe not make one size fit all, but try to find out what is needed in Washington County versus San Juan versus Davis County versus Cache County. In order to do this right, it's going to take a little bit of time. But I think that it doesn't mean that we stop everything, although someone could make an argument that if you could hit a pause button while we gather more data, which is really what we're talking about, there could be value in that. I just don't see how we can do it. But it does argue that we need to spend that time and then come back to the table as a broad stakeholder group and start working on how we enhance and improve that. So a big part of this conversation, and Representative Miles was part, so was Representative Hollins and others. There were at least 7 or 8 bills this last session, as the session started, that would have required local law enforcement agencies to provide a certain amount of data. Many of the agencies in our state aren't capable of providing that. They don't have the resources to query it, and they don't have an easy way to pull that data out of their systems. That is a problem. But it's not an intentional pushing back by any means. It's truly, it just hasn't existed, which is why for years, as we come forward with legislation or policy, and you may have a bill that you strongly support, and you ask CCJJ or others for data, we provide you with the best data we have, which our folks are amazing, and they are very talented, and they can find things that I, quite frankly, wouldn't think we can find. But they're only getting 30%, which doesn't really help you as a legislator or someone like me in a policy role to really be able to say with some level of confidence, this is going to be the outcome. So data is going to have to be probably the biggest push that we make in the criminal justice system going forward over the next few years. And I think if we can do this, and the conversations have been very positive, I know that you as legislators are looking at putting some money aside for this, and the governor's office is very much behind this. I think we have an opportunity to start something that we all have been asking for, but we haven't been either willing or able or at a point that everybody was on board enough that we could actually start this. But think for a moment, somewhere in the future, that if Tom Ross, a first touch with law enforcement, all the way through prosecution, courts, defense, maybe incarceration, treatment, probation, and parole, that we had a number or some way that's not directly tied to my name to know what happened and what's worked and what is not working. That is, I think, what all of us would like to get to. And the first step in that is to connecting our local law enforcement, municipal, county, sheriff systems, disparate systems, in a way that we can pull that data out on an ongoing basis. So what we start tomorrow, we continue to pull for decades to come. And we can add to that list of data points each year where that data is going to be helpful. So the reason I spend so much time at the front end of kind of approaching it this way is I can't sit in front of you and say, this is working, this is what's working great, and this is what the problem is. Because I don't know that we all even know that. I've heard the stories, I've heard the issues that have been raised. I appreciate the conversations because there are folks that are saying, when they say it's not working, they're bringing up specific circumstances that we need to be aware of and we need to be responding to. But I will also say that there are hundreds, if not thousands, that have positively benefited by the changes that have been made with JRI. So who's right and who's wrong? I think it's the concept that we have to get behind as a state, and then let's elevate this dialogue, let's elevate this collaboration, and then make those decisions going forward that will improve it and enhance it. So I'm excited about those possibilities and those options. You talk about supporting local correction systems. New Executive Director Brian Nelson, that you know, came from a sheriff's background. He's very engaged and involved in this. We've been meeting as stakeholders on the state side. There's meetings that are occurring on the local side. As we go out and do this, almost a tour, I guess, as we go region by region, these state entities, DPS, Corrections, Board of Pardons and Parole, APMP, they're going to be part of those. So we're listening from local folks, what's happening in their area, and from a state level, we're able to tell them what we're doing and what we believe is maybe a way to help work through some of those. But again, it's being able to identify what is needed specifically when it comes to whether there's costs associated with it, whether it's, again, a policy change that we need to make, or something in our sentencing or in our criminal justice processes. But we're looking at that. Improving and expanding reentry and treatment services. There are some really exciting things happening in this state. But again, it'd be nicer to be able to know exactly what is happening, what is working the best, and then be able to maybe move some of those programs out. A good example is, you've heard me talk about this in the past, is our Davis County Receiving Center. It's a year and less than a year and a half in. The early results are very positive, very, very positive. That still doesn't tell us what the long-term results will be, but the early results are something that we should be looking at and expanding. And as you're well aware, Representative Elison and others, Representative Hutchings, when he was here, very involved in the same space, we're now moving receiving centers out to Salt Lake County, Utah County, Washington County. So as we do this in more areas, maybe as that data comes back and we can see what is working well and what isn't, we can expand on that. Doug Thomas and his folks, Tracy Gruber, we're having meetings and conversations looking for ways to identify the best opportunities and move those throughout the state. As I've talked with folks in rural Utah, one of the opportunities of being in this position is we travel around when there's judicial vacancies. And we sit down with nominating commissions who are made up oftentimes of representatives from local government and those communities. And we get to talk and hear from them. And they're saying, hey, that's great that you have these treatment opportunities available in on the Wasatch Front. We don't have them here. So when you talk about releasing somebody from incarceration, what do they go to? We don't have the support and the foundation to help them be successful. We need to work on that. That's where we're talking about, is trying to see what works and then putting those resources together and moving those out. Strengthening probation and parole supervision. My heart goes out to these folks. I got to be honest with you. You can't help but believe that if we're going to reduce putting people in jails and prisons and ask people to manage them on the street, that as we reduce that number, this number goes up. But I don't know that we have adequately supported those folks. They'll say that maybe we haven't. Others are saying that we are doing a better job. But I don't think it's happening at the local level. As we moved some of those felonies to misdemeanors, that put that group at a local level, which a year earlier, before JRI, they would have been managed by APMP or at a state level. Now, in many of these cases, nobody's managing them. So I think there's some things that we can do, that lessons that we're learning and have learned, that we can improve and enhance, which is, I think, exactly what you're looking for in your bill, Representative Miles, is we want to make sure that people are on top of this and reporting back that we're actually moving this ball forward instead of this back and forth battle. And I will end it with just making this comment, because I think it's very relevant and I think it's adding to the level of frustration. COVID. Think for a minute what's happened to our criminal justice system during 2020. Because not only did we have the JRI programs that were in place, we have released significantly more people to keep them alive. Whether it was in a correction system or jails not booking misdemeanors. When COVID came into play, we stopped or significantly reduced those areas. Arguably the right thing to do. But you have to believe that that's had some impact on crime. And we're trying to gather that to determine it, but there's a lot more frustrated. I think the rhetoric is heated, more heated today than it even was 2 years ago with JRI or a year ago. And I think that COVID in 2020 is playing into this. That's a good and bad. Here's the negative is that we don't really know what's playing in, and we blame it on these systematic changes. Bail reform. We're blaming a lot of things on bail reform, and I'll sit in front of you and tell you I'm not convinced that it's bail reform. It could be any one of these other things that we just talked about. But when we don't know, we blame it on what we think is the closest to us or maybe what we're right in front of. And we've got to be able to get to move past that as well. So that's where we're at. As I stepped in and I sat in that chair and I started thinking, what in the heck have I done? Not that there aren't great people. This isn't about what I can do or not do. But I'm looking at this from a newcomer perspective at CCJJ with old eyes from law enforcement. And I'm going, how do we do this in a way that is timely, which we all need, is representative of what is really happening so that we don't just jump and jump and jump and jump to conclusions and assumptions, anecdotal stories that really don't help until we get the data that we can actually start seeing that plays into it. But that's what I think is the right path. Staff at CCJJ in our conversations, we feel strongly that this is the right direction to go. All of the partners that I've talked to at a local and state level feel the same way, and that's really what we're looking to do and just don't know exactly how long that's going to take. So hopefully that's helpful.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Stoddard.
I have a question for Chief Ross. I appreciate the changes that have been made in reporting, especially on the prosecutorial side, without talking poorly of CCJJ anyway. The only consequence for not doing this type of reporting is an inability to receive grants from CCJJ. But I know a lot of agencies aren't complying and have no intention of complying. Do you have any suggestions on what we can do to be able to collect this data for prosecutors? Because I think it is essential to our policymaking.
I do, because I think it's the bigger data discussion piece. So while we have all these conversations happening, you have Senate Bill 159, which is an attempt. Multiple legislators kind of came together. Instead of everyone running their own bill, let's do something bigger. So to your point, if all we do is come back with the stick piece, which some would argue is right, we're still not going to win that because we haven't. My 34 years of law enforcement, of watching how this plays out, has told me that there's a local piece to this that has to be understood and recognized and included, and there's a state piece. They don't always mesh, yet I would argue that that's primarily because we don't spend enough time on the front end collaborating, and we spend more time pushing forward a good idea that makes sense to some, that others are opposed to it before it even hits the road. So I would say to that, my recommendation would be that we don't push the stick piece of that until we are able to have these conversations at this bigger SB 159 level, and first try to bring everybody together and then use that group to help bring the others along. I've seen that work well at times in the past, and especially in an environment such as law enforcement, that you have all these areas that have their specific responsibilities and oftentimes believe and maybe are doing the right things, but we want to do something at a state level. If we don't have enough of those collaborative conversations at the beginning and get those agreements, we'll just be embattled and it's not sustainable. So that goes to my argument that we need some time to do this right, but I think if we do this right, we'll have the data.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jenkins, we did have Representative Miles. It's been queued up for about 14 minutes.
Thank you. Let me just start by saying, you know, you'll always be Chief Ross to me. That's,
sounds good. I appreciate it.
It's so nice to have your perspective and to have you on CCJJ and directing there. I think it was a brilliant move, and I think we're already seeing some of the benefits and the results just from how you've approached this, this new request to provide this information. I mean, the fact that you went right down through the highlights of the bill, you know, and because we've got to be able to rely on data, and we've got to be able to rely on someone that can bring that data to us in a way that we can make policy decisions. And so I just want to say right out of the chute, I appreciate that you've established an approach now And hopefully the word gets out that we need this information and that we need this data to make it work. And I agree. I think there's a lot of good about the programs, you know, the justice initiatives and that have come through. But somehow we've got to identify, like you say, what's working and what isn't working, and not just throw the whole program out. So thank you for your approach, and look forward to hearing even more detailed reports as we go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jenkins.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't know how to turn on my request to speak. So I assume that you might be talking about HB 288 from last year, about the data gathering.
I'm not talking about any specific. I think that's what Representative Stoddard was referring to. So that is obviously a data piece of legislation.
It's just, okay. I completely agree with you that we need data. And it's kind of shocking that at this point in, you know, history that we aren't getting that data. And I know that we need to bring people to the table, but with this, I mean, we do have this bill that was passed, this legislation, then this statute, that data does need to start being submitted. And so I'm assuming, maybe from what you've said, that there's been a lot of resistance to that in different places. No?
I think first off, to your bill, we are still moving forward with that process. I agree with you that the bill's passed. There's data that we can gather, and we should be gathering. I think what's going to be interesting is we go forward with it. So you have a big data push, let's say, and then you have all these smaller data pieces that people are, legislators and others are wanting. Somewhere in the translation of that, we could have battles pop up, and people are thinking we're talking about this bigger drive, and we're actually talking about the smaller piece. So I'm not completely sure how all that plays out, because I don't think we can just stop what we're doing and wait till we get this big piece in that could take us 2-3 years. But it would be unfortunate if, and maybe the best, the response to Representative Stoddard is, if the relationships break down while we're trying to do this prosecutor data piece, and it keeps us from doing this bigger piece, that would be unfortunate. And I do think there's a risk with everything that we're trying to do at CCJJ that people will confuse it. It's like you really can't talk about just GRI without talking about recidivism, bail reform, you know, technical violence, all these things that are all equally important and play a role in it. But sometimes people just take the negative and say, well, this whole concept is bad. So I worry that a big data push could get hurt and damaged based on smaller things that we are doing. But I think we have to play that out. And part of the role of mine and others is to, when we see that happening, is to try to get people back together and work through it. So we're not holding anything back. In fact, I know this week that they were out in Tooele County and gathering data, and maybe Cache County. So I know that our folks are moving forward gathering it, but I just, and we've talked about this, the odds are at the end, we still may not have everything that we want.
Right.
And I'm trying to help us have a collaboration that maybe gets us past those typical roadblocks that have just shut us down.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
So we'll see.
May I ask one more question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Thank you. So yeah, it sounds like you're in a really tough spot with lots of moving pieces and parts, and I don't know, so I feel for you. But you spoke at the beginning that we need to find out what's working and what's not working, right? And that there's smaller jurisdictions and larger jurisdictions and people cooperative, uncooperative, all this different stuff. But is there a standard or idea of what it looks like if something is working? Like, do these jurisdictions know this is what we expect this to look like when it is working?
So,
or would that
know.
Even be helpful?
So this is what's been interesting in the conversations that I've been a part of. And it's bigger than just talking about data. The most success we have in actually working through and getting to a point where we can start feeling, where we feel good about outcomes, is when we have enough of a collaboration at the front end, enough people around the table with varying points of view and opinions and ideas, and they feel like by doing this, there's a consensus to it. I don't think we've done as good a job, and I'm guilty of that as anyone else. I was in the law enforcement side. I don't think we've done a good job of really doing the collaboration piece. We pulled in, so if you want some law enforcement data, we pull in the law enforcement folks. But it has to be broader than that, because people that are asking for the data may be the defense side, may be asking for it. It may be a CCJ organization, legislators. So I think if we can get the right people, enough people around the table, which is a big group, have some smaller working groups, and have that group agree on this movement, I think that will tell us more confidently that this is working. Otherwise, I still think there can be successes by maybe in Washington County, they identify a couple of areas that they want improved that are fit under what JRI is, that's different than what Davis County identifies. And we as a state support that and say, that's great. As long as we're making improvements, maybe it doesn't have to be everybody doing the same thing. That's a tougher sell in the conversations that I've been a part of over the years. So I don't know. Others probably would sit in front of you and say they have a good idea, maybe even a better idea than I do, because there's some much smarter people in this. But if I can't figure it out and can't sit in front of you and say this is what's working, this isn't what's working, there's a whole lot of other people that can't either. And I think that's where we're at.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gwynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a statement, really. The kingdoms that Director Ross is talking about do exist, but the kingdoms notwithstanding, you know, I appreciate this need and push for data, but if I may be so blunt, that data is just not easy to get to because we're dealing with the human variable, especially when it comes to mental health and when you're dealing with mental health responders and law enforcement responders. So I'm in another working group where we're trying to do what we can to remove law enforcement from mental health responses, especially when they're not needed. And so we asked a very simple, or what we would believe to be a simple question is, what's the mental health response like in Weber County? The answer to that question depends on who you ask. Are you asking Weber Mental Health? Are you asking Uni? Are you asking the Crime Analysis Center? Are you asking dispatch? Are you asking the individual agencies? And sometimes this mental health data is concealed and you have to try and flush it out. And you have to do that call by call by call by call, for instance. So I asked that question in Weber County between May 1st of 2020 and May 1st of 2021. There were approximately 2,000 responses to mental health calls by law enforcement. What that doesn't include is people that are self-responding to Weber Mental Health. It doesn't include people who are calling Weber Mental Health. It doesn't include people who are responding to Uni who may actually be getting information that requires them to call law enforcement. Okay, so I'm expecting, okay, we're gonna get just a number of responses to mental health calls in Weber County. And so I get that. I get it for all the individual cities. But wouldn't you know it, not everything is considered just a mental health call. This is how they were broken down. Suicide threat, psychiatric, overdose, welfare check, family disturbance, disturbance other, assist other jurisdiction, juvenile disturbance, citizen assist, suspicious circumstance, cardiac arrest, weapons disturbance, gunshot wound, unknown problem, suspicious person, unconscious problem, keep the peace, unknown trouble, stabbing. We're trying to pull data from calls that have other concealing elements or may not be able to be narrowed down to just one problem, i.e. mental health. And you have more than one agency responding to these types of calls. So we need the data. But to sit here and say, well, we should have it already or we should be able to get that, it's not as easy as you would think. And if you're not looking at the data correctly, or if you're misinterpreting what you have, or you have too much, right? You actually have the potential to make the wrong decisions based on what you have in front of you. So not only do we got to have the right data, we've got to be able to verify that that data is actually correct. What is it about that data that we're not seeing? Is what we are seeing actually what the problem is that we're trying to solve? So I just want to make that clear. I appreciate what Chief Ross is trying to do, but we have to understand it's not going to be a simple task. And I don't think that these agencies that aren't, I'm not saying there aren't any, they're not willing to provide the data, they simply can't, or they just don't know how to provide it. So
thank you. Representative Ballard.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really interesting coming into this committee because I'm hearing a lot of law enforcement and lawyer perspective, and I'm coming into it from a family supportive of a criminal perspective. And I think we all at some point know someone who's been in, and I have a relative who's been in and out for 30 years and is currently in. And so I just wanted to mention the importance of the data, because it ends up causing problems in preventing recidivism for the inmates when they don't even have their medical records clear, which have barely started to become available. I think this data is crucial for the treatment side within the institutions, for them to connect their goals with education and with work, and even become self-sufficient in their finances. So I'm looking at this at even a broader perspective, other than just what the law enforcement needs. There's a lot of updates that need to be taken place. And I'm, as the Vice Chair of Higher Education, and looking at the two chairs that are also in this committee, we have for the first time asked in higher education for the correctional facilities to actually come to higher ed and say, what is your plan in helping your inmates to actually get some education if they're going to be in there for an extended period of time? There hasn't been that collaboration for years, if ever. So I appreciate you trying to bring the silos together. It's time. We live in 2021. We need the data to help our those criminals to prevent the to prevent recidivism, but also to empower those in the field who are trying to understand the circumstances that they're in. So I appreciate all your work. I've got some ideas, I think, to work with you. But this is one of the most important places for this legislature to invest in and to update.
Thank you. Senator Ipsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have to agree with Representative here. You'll always be the chief. And you've been a great asset to the Hill, to the profession. And I'm confident that you're going to bring expertise and a different perspective to your present job. And I look forward to the great results that I think you'll have. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Reby.
Thank you. I'd like to echo some of the sentiments that I've heard already. I think that we are hearing some of these things, and we start to hear dollar signs going in the background. Ching, ching, ching. I mean, it's going to be expensive, we think. But when you start to look at how we are duplicating so many of these services, going from one agency to the next agency to the next agency, people that are in crisis are not always showing up to the same person and the same service. They are showing up to service to service to service, and they're getting different requirements and different needs met. And so if we can break down these silos and start having a continuity of care where we can start getting all those services in one streamlined thing, I think we'll be saving ourselves money instead of duplicating all these services. As a teacher, when you have a kid who's in peril and a family who's in peril, we get them straightened out in one school, and then they get evicted and they go to the next school, and we start from scratch again. So hopefully we can start moving their data with them and protecting those families so that they can get the services they need. And so when I think of the end game, what our goal might be, it might be that we have a path that each agency can follow that can be picked up where another one left off. You know, when some of these policies started, we were not as mobile as we are now, and we also didn't have the technology we have now. We are way more mobile, and we have way more, we have a ton of technology, and we can follow our people where they're going, and we can help them with these services in a more efficient manner instead of duplicating them over and over again or starting from square one. So when I look to this, that would be my goal, that we could have a continuity of care and not keep duplicating services or actually asking these people who are really struggling to have five different agendas they have to follow. One consistent agenda that's going to get them through whatever they need to get the services they need. So that would be my ask, or that would be a goal that I would hope that we could start to achieve.
I agree. Thank you, Representative Romero.
Yeah, and I won't duplicate what others have kind of mentioned that I agree with Representative Ballard and Senator Reby, but I just look at this from a social determinants of health perspective. And when you're looking at an individual, how do all these things impact them, whether it's their mental health, their physical health, their emotional health? And so we've been successful when we were addressing COVID-19 with some of the funding we got. We had community health workers when people were getting tested for COVID. We partnered with the county and the state, well, us as the state and the city, and identified other ways in which to help people because they weren't just getting a COVID test. Were they hungry? Were they able to pay their rent? And so I think when we collaborate like this, we address the person as a whole, and then we're not duplicating efforts all the time. So I look forward to watching you move us in that direction.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Burton.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner, I'll call you that. Thomas, good to have you here, and thanks for your leadership on this very complex problem. A lot of smart people have tried to fix it over the years. Having come from a large structure called, we went through something similar with database. So in a panacea perfect world, there would be a database of record that everyone fed into. And that when the governor asked the commissioner of public safety to give him a report, he could just print it up. That currently does not exist. Am I correct in saying that?
That's correct if you're looking at it from a statewide perspective.
Can you conceive of a system or is there a best practice out there in another state? Because we had to actually bring in software writers and actually develop a database of record. All other databases were not utilized going forward once that thing was implemented. It was beta tested and then implemented. Can you conceive that working here if it was umbrellaed by the state and we brought somebody in to help develop such a database? Could it be used in the departments like Matt was talking about earlier? Is there a way to standardize that into one database if enough money and effort is thrown at it?
So my opinion is no, and I'll tell you why. I think that, I had a lot of involvement on the UC, on the Utah Communications Authority Board, especially over the years. They were trying to get every dispatch center in the state on one system. And that doesn't work well. There's, especially in our state, where there's very much a feeling of what works for me is better than what works for you, and people like their choice. There could even be an argument that you may lose innovation and cost pricing when everybody's on the same system. Now, I'm not talking military because that's much bigger, but I think what is the technology absolutely exists, and what is a better path for us would be to have disparate systems. We have four records management systems in the state of Utah for police agencies. We're gonna have two, three jail systems. You can have disparate systems and have a software capability to either have data pushed to that and stored, if we choose to store it as a state, or be able to reach in and query that data as we make those requests. And have those, the collaboration between the groups, everyone agrees on what data points we will share. That would be part of this collaboration. I believe that is the most likely scenario that will get us forward. Because the technology does exist, and it's improved over the years. Doesn't mean we won't have road bumps, but it, to have the state be in any way look like we're saying everyone needs to be on Ross software system X, we won't win it. And I've watched that play out over not all of my career, but at least over the last 15 plus years.
Mr. Chair, one more quick question, if I may.
Go ahead.
So based on what you said, if there was a way to bridge these existing databases, that would be the ideal. And so for me as a legislator, I'd be very interested in talking to you more about how we do that, because I think that would solve so many problems. If these systems, if not talking to each other, we could query and get the information that we need to answer questions across the spectrum.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that was, I think you heard from almost everyone. I do enough talking. Thank you. We're looking forward to utilizing your expertise and your experience and your insight. So welcome to my committee, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again. Thank you, Chief Ross.
Thank you.
Committee, we're almost done with our business. I'm going to go to John briefly to discuss a motion that we need to adopt.
Thank you, Senator Grover, Chair Grover. As discussed during an earlier study item, we need, the committee needs to, John Feinauer, Policy Analyst with the Office of Legislative Research, General Counsel. As discussed earlier, the committee is asked to vote on the study items that have been prepared and proposed and suggested by the Legislative Management Committee. So I'll go ahead and share those again. And they also should be available under meeting materials listed as 2C, I believe, or 2B. Yes, it should say study items. So the items as currently constituted, but it's for the committee to make a motion to either make changes to the document and then approve it or approve it as is.
Okay, thank you, John. So the items there are mental health and public safety, privacy and criminal justice, driving under the influence, recruitment and retention, we've kind of started that today, law enforcement training policies, again, we started the and bail reform. Go to Senator Ebsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to adopt these as interim study items.
That motion's in order. The motion that's before us to adopt these as interim study items. Any conversation or discussion of that motion? Seeing none, back to the maker of the motion.
Away.
Okay, the motion for us is to adopt these items that you see on the screen or on your computer. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that passes unanimously. I'll obtain one final motion from...
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn, non-debatable. All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Too bad. We're adjourned.
Like that Russian guy said, right?